Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the program. My name is Simon Barrett. This week, we're going to be doing something a little different. Our focus is going to be on a crime that happened over 30 years ago. Yep, you heard that right. No politics. Not much politics. The crime remained an open investigation. Well, that's a bit of an exaggeration. The file was put in some dark, dusty, long-forgotten storeroom, and the police went back to more lucrative tasks, like handing out speeding tickets. Joining me on air today, I have assembled an awesome panel. From LA, we have well-known and well-respected attorney Peter Haven. Peter, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much, Simon, and a happy Easter to everyone. It's good to be here.
Right. And you're probably marginally grumpy with me because I really haven't shared the nits and grits of this story with you. But I did that for a good reason. I want a new set of eyeballs and ears and brain to talk about it. So I wasn't excluding you on purpose.
Well, that's okay. It feels like we're about to go on an Easter egg hunt, so thanks very much. I like that.
All right. From the absolute epicenter of the so far discovered world, Youngstown, Ohio, we have author, activist, bar owner, and general roustabout, Sam Murphy. Sam, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me. I can't wait. I'm looking forward to this program, and happy Easter to everybody, as Peter said, and I think the last night of Passover, too. And don't forget the Ten Commandments after the show. Always a great thing to watch on Easter Sunday.
Right, yeah. I will bear that in mind. We also have two special guests. They know more about this case than anyone else. Paul Scharf has a personal interest. One of the two victims in the double homicide that happened in 1981 was his father, Ronald Scharf. Paul, welcome to the program.
Hello, Simon. Hello, everybody. Happy Easter.
Also joining us is writer Keith Bessinger. Keith and Paul collaborated on the just-published book, Murder in McHenry. Keith, it is a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Simon. I finally get to talk to you. It's been a long time that I've heard about you.
And I'm sure it was all bad.
No, there was a little bit of good in there.
Right. Now, if I'm correct, you are in Las Vegas. I have a suspicion as to how you and Paul got connected, but I'm sure it's a subject that will come up later in the program.
Oh, it will.
Oh, it will. Yeah. I guess my suspicion is correct. Okay, let's get started. Paul, set the scene for us. Give us a thumbnail sketch of what happened in 1981.
Sure. I'm Paul Scharf. I'm the eldest son of Ron Scharf, who was gunned down June 2nd, 1981, in an unincorporated part of McHenry called Lakemore, Illinois. It was at our tavern called the PM Pub, which is about 40 miles northwest. My father was gunned down with his employee, Patricia Freeman. At the time of the murder, this is a small, sleepy town. We kind of felt like this was a little bit out of the scope of the McHenry County Sheriff's Department's abilities. We've never had a murder out there. That was the first murder that Lakemore has ever had. And they took over the investigation. They had what they felt was a hot suspect. The suspect, his first name is Glenn, and he was the boyfriend to Patricia Freeman. And he was kind of framed up in the jealous boyfriend type, and that, you know, his motive was that he didn't like his girlfriend working for my father. So he was the big suspect in the murder, but this case just went cold. It went unsolved for many, many, many years, and me and the community itself often wondered, you know, what happened, who killed my father and Patricia Freeman.
Okay, now, if I have this right, and, you know, I frequently get things not right, you were 11 years old at the time.
That's correct.
Right, but you never lost interest in finding the truth. I won't say it was an obsession. Yeah, it was more like a dull headache.
Absolutely. I'm the eldest son of Ron, so you know there's always that passion inside me to find out what happened to my father.
Right. So I think it was 2009. Everything changed. A book was published.
Yeah, actually, it was 2008. My former babysitter, Holly Hager, she was driving her father home back from Arkansas, from Illinois. Her father is named Jim Hager, and he was my dad's best friend. And so as they were traveling, Holly asked him, you know, who do you think killed Ron? And he mentioned the suspect, Glenn, but he also mentioned a guy named Larry Newman. So when Holly went back home, she started Googling Larry Newman. And the first thing that he came up on was a serial killer site, and it was noted that he was from McHenry, our hometown. So she kept on Googling further, and then she traced it to a book named Colada. It was about a former Chicago gangster who turned government witness. So she immediately got the book to herself. And on page 130, it detailed my father's unsolved murder. It mentioned him not by name, but mentioned the circumstances, and Holly immediately matched that up to my father's murder. So she grabbed all the information that she was getting from the internet and the book itself, and then she shipped it down to her father. Her father went ahead, looked over the material, and then one day gave me a phone call and asked me, hey, you know who killed your father, right? And I said, well, if it was in this morning's paper, I missed it, so why don't you fill me in? And that's when he started explaining to me all these crazy names, Frank Collada, Tony Spilatro, Larry Newman, kept on mentioning the movie Casino. I was very confused at the moment. My mouth was, dropped. And, I couldn't, I'm like, how many people killed my father? And it's Larry Newman. So how does this work back to Colada? So it was quite an experience. It was quite an informative phone call I received.
Okay. Peter, you know almost nothing about this case. But what do you think so far?
Well, it raises a lot of questions, and obviously it's very interesting. Paul, do you have any opinion as to who killed your father as you sit here today?
Yeah, absolutely. More than just an opinion. The case did get reopened, or actually reinvestigated. And Larry Newman, he was in prison for a murder, and he died in prison, but under exceptional status, he was named as the killer of my father, Patricia Freeman.
Now, I take it, so this is the serial killer that you referred to?
Correct.
Okay, so he was caught for another murder, and then while he was in prison, somebody established that he was the person who killed your father and his employee, and I'm very sorry about that. I know it's well past that deadline, but nonetheless.
Thank you for that.
Yeah. My great grandfather, by the way, was stabbed to death in Chicago, but that's a whole other story. So you believe that the serial killer is the one who killed your father, and it wasn't in fact the boyfriend who was initially suspected.
That is correct. Larry Newman, he was already convicted in Illinois prior to this in 1956 of a triple murder, where he murdered a bar owner, a barmaid, and a poor newspaper vendor right outside of that bar. That occurred in 1956, and he was sentenced to 125 years for that. And Illinois justice, he only had to serve 12 before he was paroled.
Now, the motive for the killing is such that he was a serial killer. Was there any other identifiable motive?
Let's come back to that.
I'm sorry. I got ahead. I was finding too many Easter eggs too fast. I apologize.
You're acting like a lawyer.
Yeah. Well, it is second nature, I'm afraid.
That's what happens when you keep them in the dark, Simon.
Yeah. Sam. You've been listening. You're a bar owner. You got any thoughts so far?
Well, I heard that name. I Tony, isn't his nickname or his mob name the Ant? Tony the Ant.
Yes.
Yeah. And yeah. I've done some research on him, and I forget, went Google and all that stuff. And that guy is some serious killer. As you pointed out, he was portrayed as Joe Pesci in the movie Casino, and how they were killed. And I do remember recently, I might have been about a year ago, reading something about a lot of the cases he was involved with or who killed him was opened up, and they put all the mobsters in Chicago or Illinois on trial again and reopened all these cases.
The Family Secrets trial.
Yeah, okay. And that's kind of going, you know, running around in my head while I was listening when I heard that name and whatnot. And I guess my like Peter, you know, 30 years later, sorry to hear what happened to your dad and all that. But is the case still being reopened and reinvestigated, or is they just running to dead ends?
It's still open.
Shame on you, Sam. Shame on you.
Yeah, you're ruining my script.
Well, what do you expect?
I guess you're right. Okay, Keith, you're in Las Vegas, and I'm guessing, and it's no more than a guess, that you got hooked up with this story by knowing a mutual acquaintance by the name of Denny Griffin.
That's correct. Denny and I have known each other for about, I'd say, 10 years.
as soon as I saw your email, I went, I know how this started. But please tell us how it started.
Are you there?
Yep.
Hello?
Yep. Keith, you know, how did you actually get involved with this case?
Hmm.
He might be screwing around with his headset.
Well, we lost someone.
I think someone.
Something tells me he'll be back.
Great. Oh, yeah. You know, people that write about mobsters, you can't get rid of them with a stick. I'm sure he'll be back. So, book gets published 2008. Holly reads it, and it stirs up a hornet's nest. What did you do, Paul? You poked and prodded the cops.
Yeah, the first thing that I did was to get a hold of Dennis Griffin. He was the author or the co-author of the book Collada, I wanted to let them know that they had an unsolved murder in their book. So through the publishing company, I sent an email to their PR person who forwarded on to Denny. And Denny got back to me. I shut off the email, I think, within 4 hours. And so we agreed that we would talk. We were going to talk the following week. Well, I got an email a day later from him, and he stated that he spoke to Frank Collada, who was the mobster that worked for Tony Spilotro and then turned government witness, and that he also spoke to FBI agent Dennis Arnoldi, who was actually Frank's debriefer, and actually caught Frank in the Bertha's burglary that sentenced him and the whole of the wall gang to their downhill spiral. And so he reached out to both Frank and Dennis Arnoldi and asked, why in 1982 did they not pass this information on to the authorities in McHenry County? Well, they said that they did.
Well, except I'm not sure they really did. You've played around with Freedom of Information Act requests. How successful have you been?
Well, what I've been able to find out, I've got most of my father's file, and I'm appealing with the Illinois State Attorney General to get the rest of it. But what we found in there is that the officer that headed out to San Diego to speak to Frank was the lead investigator, George Hendel himself, along with State's Attorney Ted Floro. They both headed out to San Diego in 1982, and they spoke to Frank. They said that they provided him with some misinformation, and he bought it up. They felt like they had a strong suspect in Glenn, as they had stated in some of the newspapers that he failed 3 lie detector tests. What I'm finding out in the investigative file 1, there was no mention of the trip to San Diego. There was no plane ticket. There was no notes. There wasn't anything of the kind. Second, Glenn did take 3 lie detector tests, but they weren't all failed. The first lie detector test was inconclusive, and it was stated that this was way too soon to be giving him a lie detector test so close to having his girlfriend being murdered. So they went ahead and they gave him a lie detector test later. In that test, they found him to be deceptive. Then his attorney and himself went out and got their own lie detector test done, and in that one, he was found to be truthful. So at the very best, you could say that it's inconclusive, I would think. But they were holding their hat high on Glenn and stating that they fed misinformation to Mr. Collada, and that was the reason for not pursuing Larry Newman.
Right, and I do believe we have Keith back on the line. Keith, are you there? He's dialed in, but he's being quiet.
He's dialed in, but he's not dialed in.
Right. Yeah. No, that's what you find with authors.
It's very mysterious. It's very mysterious. I'm starting to get concerned.
Peter,
can you hear me now? Yay.
Yeah.
Yay.
Yeah. Okay, so
I had one of those wardrobe malfunctions.
Oh, okay. All right. Right before you took your trip, shall we say, I was asking you about how you got involved, and obviously there was a Denny Griffin element.
Yes, there was. Denny had spoken to Paul quite often about and relayed information to Paul, and Paul had discussed with him doing a book. And Denny had so many books at the time in his radio show going that he just couldn't keep up with it, so he asked me would I speak to Paul. And Paul and I spoke together, and we decided we could work together, and we put this book out there after about 3.5 years of writing it.
Oh, writing a book is a really hard thing to do. You got to fiddle with it. You got to make sure it's just right. Are you happy with the end result?
I'm happy with it, yes. It took a while, some discussions back and forth. We started off in the wrong direction first, and we regrouped. We worked on it. It was coming out fine. Then Paul's computer crashed with all the information on it, and he had to rebuild that. And finally, we got it all put together. We found a fantastic publisher that's working with us, and I'm very happy with the outcome.
Hear, hear.
Yeah, and Paul, I'm sure you're really happy with the final product.
Oh, more than happy. I'm definitely a person with high expectations, and I knew that this was really personal to me, and that it just might not meet all them expectations. And it did. It exceeded them. So I'm more than happy about this book.
Let's go to Sam, because, Sam likes to talk.
Right now I'm enjoying listening to a story. But I was wondering about writing books. Yeah, that's right up my alley. I mean, I write fiction books. Although, from what it sounded like, it almost sounded like a part of fiction. Unfortunately, it's a true thing that someone got killed and all that. But it sure has all those, these older cases that keep popping up to some of these old gangsters that just, like Whitey Bulger and Billy Bulger, whatever his name was, and some of these other stories that come up. Oh, Billy was his brother, the corrupt politician. But and then the
correct
insider FBI, the insider, and I heard someone mention the FBI and this and that. Are they doing anything? My thing to you guys, and I don't know what you found out, but I have found the FBI and the community I live in less than honest, sometimes even more dirtier than the guys, the people they're investigating. And and incredibly bad at sharing information, especially information from a long ago. And what I've come to my own conclusion about it is when they've got something to hide, the reason they're not sharing is they've got something to hide. Dirty hands. Not all law enforcement is, we all like to believe that the FBI was something when I was a kid. My mother was in love with the FBI TV show with Efren Zimbalist Jr. Mm-hmm. And that's what we all wanted them to be like, but they're not.
Well, in this case, that doesn't apply. The stereotypical scene doesn't apply here. The FBI agents actually involved with this stuff here were exceptional agents. They were agents of change, and they were doing everything that they could. Well, maybe not everything they could, but they were doing mostly of everything they could to get this information to McHenry County. It was the problem in McHenry County. That's our bottleneck.
Okay, now the county, Was it the county just they didn't want to open up an old case, or they don't have the money? With the usual, oh, we don't have the money, the time, the manpower, woman power to do all this, and just you know, why are you doing this? What, you know, it's long ago type stonewalling, for lack of a better term. Is that what you ran into at the local level?
Well, it's more simpler than that. It's Illinois outside of Chicago, linked to the Chicago outfit, and that's where the sheriff was. The sheriff was in the pocket of the Chicago outfit.
The outfit, okay. That's Capone's old luck place.
That's correct.
Right, Capone's correct. And Nitty and all
organized.
Okay, got it.
Yep.
And Peter, doesn't it scare you, you know, to be on a program like this?
Well, you know, it's funny. It is a little scary, I have to admit. And I think about these things all the time, every day, because we, as you know, we tend to take for granted concepts of law and order. And law and order is really only as good as the ability of all of us to maintain it. And you never know when you're going to rub shoulders with or encounter a force in this world that simply doesn't play by those rules. And we take it for granted. And I think of it on a small scale, and I think of it on a big scale. And those are poor choices of words. I mean, I think about it in terms of interpersonal human-to-human relations and relations between nations. There are parallels there, and what's true at the macro level is also true at the micro level, and that does cross my mind, and I think about that kind of stuff all the time.
Keith, you know, I'm pretty certain that, you know, as you're a friend of Denny's, You obviously have an interest in the mob. Does it scare you to, you know, play around in this arena?
No, not really. I mean, we didn't hurt the mob itself with writing this book. The mob had already been hurt. Larry Newman was dead. We don't know where his ex-wife Debbie is right now. I will say that. Being in law enforcement for almost 25 years prior to this, I'm kind of used to the fringe of things.
I love the phrase, you know, used to the fringe.
Well, you run into people. I mean, you go places, you lock people up, you see them on the street afterwards. Well, it's just part of life.
Paul, so, you know, you cause a ruckus. I think it was more than just you. You know, Denny caused a ruckus, you caused a ruckus, and I caused a ruckus.
Yeah,
the cops finally decided, oh crap, we got to find that old dead case, you know, dust it off, and start again. I was told that they had 20 detectives actively working it. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that was correct. That was correct.
All right. So, you know, I'm the guy, you know, creating havoc online, and I reach out and touch McHenry County. They don't much care for me.
No, they don't.
Right. But they couldn't duck me for too long.
That's okay. They care for me much less.
Right. So, yeah, they ducked me for a while, but finally, you know, someone has to talk to me. And the 20 is now 2. You know, Paul, were you upset by that?
Well, you know, the issue started off with, you know, them making an effort. We were actually doing an interview with NBC Channel 5 News in Chicago with Carol Marine. So they had already taped my side of the story, and they were going back to the sheriff's office to get their side of the story, and they kept on delaying and delaying and delaying. They were making these milestones, and they were never being met. Finally, the Channel 5 News said, you know, we just got to go with this. And they went with the story of the was a small-town mob murder covered up. And that kind of gave me the theme of, you know, saying what it is that I couldn't say. I had to show that I, you know, that I was open to anything. But Carol Marine went ahead and said that and kind of gave me a platform to stand on. And from there, it looked like that they were trying to slide the resources downward, and they were starting to go into a back room with it. And after not meeting the milestones that they set for themselves, I became concerned, and they wouldn't return my phone calls. So I started creating situations where not talking to me was much worse than talking to me.
Well, you know, that's pretty much the way I work, right? It's better to talk to me than not talk to me.
That's correct. I figured that out quickly, and that's what I leveraged.
Keith, you didn't know anything about this case.
I had no idea whatsoever about anything until Denny asked me to speak to Paul.
Right. What do you make of it? You know, has justice been served? In my opinion, no. But I'd love to hear, you know, your thoughts.
Well, I mean, looking at this case to a couple different ways. As the writer of the story, I need to get the information. But that the other one, looking at it as a former cop, I understand some of the mindset of the law enforcement looking into the case. So I looked at it both ways, and I always like to play devil's advocate when we go over stuff too. Now, with this case, I could understand them looking at the first suspect as it, because you look closest to home for it, and Glenn would have been a prime suspect. They should have been able to eliminate him. Once they got the statement from Frank Collada, who, as a government witness, if he got caught in a lie, all the deals were off, he would be away either for life or maybe a death penalty for some of the cases he was involved in, or he would have wound up dead in prison because somebody would be making their bones for the mob. But the way law enforcement went about it, I just took an interest in writing about this and running with it like Paul was. Let's get this out in the open. This is not right.
Okay. You know, the cops had this hot theory about Glenn, but, you know, it wasn't a good theory. As I understand it, Larry Newman was a name that was brought up. How come the cops avoided anything to do with Newman back in 1981?
I don't know if they really knew that much about Newman in 91. Other than what Jim Hager told them. But I went to one of Frank Collada and Denny Griffin's little meet and greet the public gatherings that they have, the little show they put on, and I outright stood up at the end of it and I asked Frank Collada, Frank, why didn't they look at Newman? And he says, because they were mobbed up.
Woohoo!
and just so I'm clear, what does that mean? They mean they were afraid to mess with the mob?
No. That means they didn't need to mess with the mob. The mob took good care of them.
Yep.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And Newman was part of the Spilotto gang?
He was part of the Hole in the Wall gang.
Hole in the Wall gang. Okay. Okay, got it. Got it. Now I do it.
Right.
Okay.
You know, the pecking order was Spilotto, Collada, but Collada needed to generate money, so he had his Hole in the Wall gang, and that they got their name because when they were going to do a robbery, they'd just bust through a wall.
That's right.
You know,
Hole in the Wall. That's how they got their name, right?
Right.
Yeah. Well, security back in those days, security was, you know, outlined behind, around doors, around windows, but there wasn't motion detectors and things like that, so it was a lot simpler just to punch a hole through the wall.
Right. You know, a small explosive or a large sledgehammer, oh, you can get through the wall easily. I'm not sure, you know, it's an ideal way of performing robberies, but hey, it worked for them for quite a long time. But I still go back to the question, why wasn't Newman a prime suspect in 1981, you know, he was there, you know, he met all of the criteria. In fact, let's talk about the criteria. Paul, it was his wife that started this, I believe.
Yes. Yeah, in about May of 1981, Larry's ex-wife was still here in McHenry, and she went up to the bar. She had too much to drink, and she was making moves on my dad. And my dad was really conservative as far as behavior in the bar. And if you start inciting behavior like that, you start losing control of your situation, and he wouldn't have any part of it. So he threw Debbie out, and it turned into a big altercation, you know, where she actually went back, got some people that she knew, family members, friends, brought them back to the bar. Words were being spat back and forth, so on and so forth. But ultimately, everybody walked away. No guns were pulled or anything like that. But my dad was certainly concerned about that incident, as he should be. And what Debbie did is she contacted Larry Newman in Las Vegas, where he was at the time, at the at Frank's restaurant, the Upper Crust, where Larry was told that my father threw Debbie out of the bar. He was told by her that my dad grabbed her by the neck and threw her out of the bar. And for Larry, Larry was friends with my dad, and he perceived this as a big, huge insult. So he became enraged, and he threatened to go back to McHenry and kill my father. Frank Collada thought he talked him out of it. He talked to him for about a half hour or hour or so, and thought he had talked Larry out of it. He said, you know, Larry, you know, is she hurt? No, she's not hurt, you know. Well, you know, this is your ex-wife. She's an ex-wife for a reason. You know, forget about it. And 2 weeks later, Larry went out to McHenry and killed my father.
Okay, Peter, I'd like to get your thoughts on this. It sounds simple, doesn't it?
Well, nothing is ever quite as simple as it sounds, but at least there seems to be an explanation for what happened, and it seems as if the person who did it was actually convicted of another murder and, if I understand correctly, died in prison. I'm not sure it's as simple as saying case closed, but, you know, there are unfortunately a lot of things in this world that go unsolved, and no form of justice ever comes about. I think there's still a lot more going on here than we've talked about, but, you know, again, it's just a constant reminder to me that, you know, there's a very thin line between law and order and you know, murder and crime and punishment.
Right. And I think it's fair to say, you know, you've seen both sides of this as an attorney. You know, you were involved with the OJ trial, the civil aspect. I mean, justice sometimes just doesn't seem to get it right.
Well, people have that perception. They have the perception that oftentimes justice doesn't work. I have a different perception of it. And, justice is nothing more than a human construct. I mean, we don't all sit back and rely on God to correct all the wrongs in our world. We have faith in that, or some sort of divinity to make things right. We have faith and hope in that and pray for things like that. But in the end, we're a society, a collection of human beings, and we try to implement justice as best we can as a human collective. And because we're trying to do it through a collection of human beings, it's fraught with human fallibility in all its forms, as broadly defined as you can imagine, everything from simple error to out-and-out corruption. And that is a process that afflicts everything, that all human groups and cultures and organizations. That's just part of what I call the human condition. I do believe that even though it doesn't always seem to work out that way, but I do have faith that in the long run, justice is served. And sometimes it's served in an indirect way. Sometimes it's served in a delayed way or a circuitous way. But I do have faith that in the end, in one form or another, justice is served. And, this appears to be another example of ways in which, for instance, the system didn't catch the guy and punish him for the crime at issue, but it appears to have caught him and punished him for another crime. And the result seems to be more or less the same. And interestingly, that was also the case with OJ.
So, right.
There are countless examples of this, but the system really fails when people lose faith in it and give up on it. Then the chances of achieving justice amongst all of us diminishes greatly. But sometimes it's strange the way things work out, but I have faith that more often than not, they do work out.
Okay. Obviously, begs the question, do you feel that you've achieved justice and this is aimed at Paul?
No, definitely not. I agree with some of what was said, and I think it's more about the community. It's the community that drives justice, and we all have roles in that. And the biggest thing that we did is we created hope for the Scharf and the Freeman family, because the community did get behind me, and it did put pressure on the McHenry County Sheriff's Office. It didn't answer the question of what happened back in 1981, which still begs to be answered, but it did put a name to the killer of my father and Patricia Freeman. And this is important. This is, the people were left behind. There's still some people that are left behind from that day that tragedy stuck with them in a way that they can't forget about it. They can't relive this. They can't talk about it. So it's important that we do go back and mark time and hold people accountable to their roles in this case.
Okay, Paul, but are you looking for revenge here, or are you just looking for justice?
No, definitely not revenge, you know. It's justice. You know, we have to hold our institutions accountable. The sheriff who was investigating this back in 1981 is no longer there and has actually passed away. But the entity itself still exists. And that's where we have to hold it accountable, saying, hey, you know, this system did fail on a certain level. Maybe it's not the same administration, but we do need to understand how we got corrupted, because we do need to prevent this in the future. And we need to be honest about our shortcomings. Your office did get corrupted. You know, let's talk about that, because you created another crime and not solving the first crime. And, you know, and that's severe. And that's what really hurts, where you feel like your community didn't care. And it was corruption that got in the way of that.
Well, Paul, let me ask you a question. I don't think that I disagree with anything you've said, and I think you and I are saying the same things in different ways. So my question to you, and this is the part that's been a little unclear to me, the part you're most troubled with is the cover-up or the corruption. So
yes.
What would you like to see happen?
What I would like to see happen is, you know, that we take this to the forum. You know, when I filed for the Freedom of Information Act, there was no information about that trip to San Diego. Well, I mean, it was huge. It was all over the Chicago papers. And the working theory that we have, and this is based on conversations with Frank Collada, Dennis Arnoldy, was that the McHenry County Sheriff's Office was connected to the Chicago outfit, and that if they were to move forward on Larry Newman, that would be giving credibility to Frank Collada. Frank Collada, at that time, was the biggest threat to the Chicago outfit in its history, only being forecast by recently by the Family Secrets trial in 2005. So Frank was going to be dismantling the Chicago outfit. The Chicago outfit had a reason to feel threatened by him, and so therefore they didn't push forward on Larry Newman. And now looking at the file, what I seen is I tied a newspaper article to a lawyer named Adam Bourgeois. Adam Bourgeois is the Chicago outfit's attorney. When Frank and Dennis Arnoldy met with the Sheriff Hendel and State's Attorney Flora in San Diego, that was McHenry County going to talk to a federal government witness. But yet, there was no charges that were ever brought forward on that information, a trial or nothing. But yet, the civil attorney has all the information about this meeting and is talking about it in the Las Vegas Sun, saying that there was discredited information that was provided to Collada. He seemed to have bought it, and that there was 3 lie detector tests done against Glenn that he all failed. So they were working hard into, you know, discrediting Frank. And then what you see in the file itself is Tommy Amata, Larry Newman, Debbie Newman. These folks all had roles in the murder, and the thing that they had in common was Adam Bourgeois. Adam Bourgeois was their representation in that. In fact, Adam Bourgeois was going to use George Hendel, the lead investigator, and State's Attorney Floro in Larry Newman's murder trial of Robert Brown. Then Tony Spilatro's attorney in 1986 was going to use Sheriff Hendel and Sergeant Massaro, I believe, for Tony Spilatro to testify on his behalf in his trial in Bertha's. I don't know if they ever actually gone to those trials to testify. I just don't know about Larry Newman's case, and Tony Spilatro was killed before he made it to his. So there's definitely a working theory that the FBI was concerned and opened an investigation on that. And there was other supporting information that kind of collaborates that as well.
Okay. Sam, you must be amazed. I mean, you know, we just got slammed with a whole bunch of information.
a lot of infamous names, I might add.
Right.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Wasn't Collada? Didn't he go? If I misheard you, he went state's witness, right? And that's what scared the heck out of the that's why he was such a threat to the outfit, right?
Absolutely. Okay. He was high up on the echelon. I mean, he was working for Tony Spilotro.
Right. Now,
Tony Spilotro had put a contract out on him, so he had nothing to lose by being a witness anymore.
Okay,
that's correct.
Okay. So he wants state's evidence and all that. And you think that the sheriff in McHenry, Illinois, all that stuff was to not investigate the murder of his father was because they just didn't want to give they wanted Collada to have no credibility, so to speak. Is that what you were? I want to make
correct.
Sure. Okay.
Correct.
That's pretty impressive thinking way. What am I doing? I mean, talk about playing the ultimate chess game. I mean, they're thinking three steps down the line.
Yes.
Okay. I mean, I find that amazing, but not so much from what I've read and about the outfit. And you know, I mean, they go all the way to. You know, there's always been rumors.
1892.
I was born in Boston. And there was always rumors around because, you know, Joe Kennedy was involved in the Kennedy family, and that they're involved with the, they helped finance the merchant, you know, that merchandise mart. What's it?
Correct. The merchandising mart. That's
okay.
The Kennedys.
They're all partners in that. I mean, so you sit there and your wheels start spinning when you start thinking about all this stuff, and then obviously to kill the people that they want to kill for whatever reason, not. Stop investigating the honest people, innocent people who are killed because they don't want someone to have credibility. I mean, that's just it's amazing how far the tentacles of the Chicago outfit go and probably still go to this day.
And on that note, I want to bring Keith on. Keith. I know that you devil in the world of the mob. Were you surprised at anything that you heard from Paul?
Not really surprised by what Paul had to say, because Paul and I talked every week on it. But I would have to say when I read some of the stuff or some of the things we discussed, it was just like, this is hard to believe that people would be this way. You know, and there are other cases from McHenry County that Paul and I have looked at and read about that are total screw-ups in the investigations as well. The Gary Gauger. Gary Gauger, Paul?
Yeah, Gary Gauger.
And, I mean, he didn't help himself either in the case, but he was convicted and sent to death row for the murder of his parents, which he didn't do, but was convicted of. It was done by two outlaw bikers who visited the place where he lived with his parents on a farm.
Yeah. In the Gary Gauger case, he was convicted, sent to death row. His conviction was based on a confession, but the confession was based on, if you were to kill your parents, how would you do it? And it was thrown out on an appeal, and while he was thrown out at death row, the Kennedy County was still attacking him in the papers, and then later it turned out that through another investigation, they had on a mic somewhere two outlaw bikers who confessed to doing that murder.
Okay, let's go back to Ronald Scharf and the other person that was killed, Patricia Freeman. Where does the case currently sit? You know, to me, it's been solved, but I'm not sure that's really true.
No, it's currently an open case still, and the grounds that I can only think of that it would be open is we still have two people that may be complicit. The first one would be Debbie Newman, Larry Newman's ex-wife, for basically taking a contract out of my father by calling her ex-husband and having my father murdered because she was thrown out the bar. And there was also another person named Tommy Amata. Tommy Amata is thought to have been with Larry that night, drove to the bar, and was out in the vehicle as Larry was murdering my father and Patricia. Nobody has ever implicated Tommy Amata as being part of it. It was more thought of as he was there, and, you know, Larry just went in, did his thing, and, you know, he just happened to be with Larry at the time. He gave an affidavit at one point saying that he was there with Larry, heard Larry go inside, shot off a few rounds and then came back out, were driving away, disassembled the weapon and threw it in one of the lakes or the rivers up in McHenry County. He later recanted that. And when he later recanted that, the one theme that was there was Adam Bourgeois. Now, the funny thing is, I'm actually friends with Tommy Amata. And from our perspective, Tommy Amata showed up first in, when I started talking to Dennis Griffin. We had thought the way that we were going to have to get justice was to reach out to Tommy Amata, work it out to where he had immunity, and have him testify. So one of the first things that I had to do was to talk to my mother. And I had to explain to her, you know, supposedly this guy was with the killer, but he wasn't complicit in any way. How do you feel about that, Mom? And my mom said, well, what was he going to do, get himself killed? And that's exactly how I felt. If he would have gone to, who is he going to go to? If he would have gone to the McHenry County Sheriff, he would have been killed. If Larry Newman had an inclination that he was even thinking about talking, he would have been killed. So we never held Tommy Amata to the degree that he didn't do his civil duty by turning himself in, you know, because that shouldn't be the barometer that if the information you provide gets yourself killed, that you should be obliged in that way. The failure was the sheriff's office. They were corrupt. Tommy had no place to go. But Tommy states that he wasn't there.
Okay. PETA, you're legal eagle. Got any thoughts?
Well, it's still all a little bit confusing to me because everyone's talking about things that they're very, very familiar with. And unfortunately, coming from a distance, I'm not familiar with all of these facts. So I think a lot of things are being assumed about, you know, what I understand and what people who aren't close to this understand. I don't know quite what can be done at this point. I don't know if it's possible to prosecute some of these people for the crimes alleged. I guess there are potential, co-conspirators in murder allegations that could be brought, but I think it's too much time has gone by to be able to successfully prosecute those things. So if the question is, can we prosecute anybody for this as far as the murder itself, the murderers, I don't think we can. As far as the complicitness or cover-up or corruption of law enforcement, I think those problems are also just as bad. And I guess another thing that occurred to me, and this is just not a legal perspective, but it was expressed that someone who was there but didn't come forward did so for fear of his life, and it seemed like a well-founded fear. Does that fear still exist for people who could be witnesses to these things? And I honestly don't know the answer to that.
I don't think so. I don't think so. And, you know, in the McHenry County Sheriff's Office went ahead and they interviewed these people in 2009 and, you know, come to the conclusion that they didn't have anything strong enough to bring forward against Debbie Newman or Tommy Amata. And I don't think that myself or my family, I don't think we take issue with that. We certainly wouldn't want to see anything happen with Tommy. At the very least, I think of him as a victim.
Talk about that for a second. I understand your feelings about Tommy, but you one of the things you said is that you know, he had a legitimate fear for his life, and I take it, you know, you genuinely believe that there was very little he could have done for fear of being killed. Is that correct?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And do you think that also that rationale could extend to anybody else?
No, I don't believe so.
Okay.
Hey, was Larry Newman, is he from McHenry County?
Yeah. Yeah, so, my father knew him.
Okay. So I was just going over that. So he asked, was his family, was he a lifetime resident there or anything? And
No, I don't know. He's originally from St. Louis. I'm not sure eventually how he migrated to McHenry.
Okay.
But McHenry was his hometown.
Okay. Did he change his name? Is he of Italian-American descent?
No, he's Jewish.
He went up to... I know he's a member of the Hole in the Wall gang.
Yeah.
And all that stuff. I've heard that. He was in that... vicious, crazy, successful, not so successful part of the outfit out in Vegas, where we all seen fictionalized, but unfortunately, some people might say romanticized, and Scorsese's Casino, and how violent and vicious and all that they were. And I mean, and there were always times where they all had to kill each other, and you know, sometimes they whack each other or whatnot. But you know, then you took the sheriff's corrupt Newman. Maybe he was the outfit's what's the word I'm looking for? He was the outfit man in McHenry, Illinois, to keep and he could make the bribes, make the payola.
I'm gonna cut you off at the knees there.
Yeah.
All right.
Boy,
he was
really
a foot soldier.
He was what?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, he was a soldier. He was an enforcer. You know, Larry Newman, he was a, you know, an extremely smart man. He had an extremely high IQ. He didn't have to kill. He had, you know, his father was rich and left him with a trust fund. We had thought that in the 70s and 60s and the 70s that he was getting $60,000 a year from the trust fund. I later found out that he was getting $30,000 a year from the trust fund. But he killed because he liked it. He was psychotic. He was a serial killer.
He hacked Bobby Brown to death with a machete because he thought he might recognize him.
Now, I recognize him, but recognize, I think it was, wasn't it
Wayne
Metecki? Metecki that was with him? Yeah. So they went to go bump off this jeweler, and they were supposed to just rob the jeweler. And Wayne Metecki was also part of the Hole in the Wall gang, and he knew the jeweler from high school or something like that. And then Larry just read into that he wasn't going to risk a loose end, and just on his own went in there, saw a machete on the wall, grabbed it, and just started hacking at Robert Brown, you know, blowing away Frank and Wayne Metecki. That wasn't the plan.
Wow.
He improvised.
I mean, he sounds like a really nice guy.
Yeah.
Someone you would want to invite for dinner.
Oddly enough, he had a nice side to him at times.
Yeah,
there was a family in McHenry that, as Paula told me, the children went over to the house and they were all invited in. Food may have been scarce, but nobody left the house hungry. And Larry would give money to the wife to go shopping.
Yeah, that's true. The husband wasn't crazy about it. The husband wasn't fantasizing about Larry Newman at all. He knew who he was, what he was, and didn't like it. But, you know, this is Chicago, and, you know, and including my father. They, you know, we're all, you know, in this fantasy of what the mob world is all like and romance about it, and, you know, these are killers.
Peter, again, I need your
adult advice.
Well,
you know,
go ahead.
What on earth are you making of this story?
You know, I hate to do it, but I have an overall view of the world. And this story, as awful and tragic and horrible as it is, it tends to be consistent with my overall impression of the world. You know, some of the things that we've talked about today, you know, someone just mentioned the fact that this psychopathic serial killer had a good side or demonstrated a good side. And, you know, in my opinion, life tends to be like a spectrum. And you take any character trait, whatever it is, and it'll align itself. You can align it in a spectrum. There'll be people on one end of the spectrum and people on the other. And it means that, in my opinion, it means that life is not always black or white, that it's various shades of gray. You can have the deepest, darkest, most sinister people that you can find, and you may actually encounter some good qualities in them on occasion. And the same thing can be said of the nicest, kindest, most saintly people. Every now and then, or they'll have aspects of their character that can actually be not so admirable. So it's consistent with that. You know, I believe that self-interest and selfishness is sadly an inherent part of life in the world, and I see it demonstrated over and over and over again, whether it be greed for the sake of acquiring money at someone else's expense, or greed as expressed by the simple desire to take someone's life simply because you want to. Sadly, that's a trait that some human beings possess. I see corruption at the local level. I see corruption at the macro level. I see corruption at the heads of nations. You know, I was reading this morning about North Korea. You know, I see this across the spectrum of human experience over and over and over again in many different forms, in many different ways, which is not to trivialize any of this. You know, I was comparing this to the stories of my own grandfather, who was a great-grandfather who was stabbed to death in Chicago. You know, these things are just, for me personally, I just feel like they're inherent aspects of human life, and I'm not quite sure what to do about any of them other than do what we're doing, which is keep talking about them, keep trying to fight against them, keep trying to, you know, cast light on what we think we should try to become as a society.
I think you're 110% right about that. You know, the process, we all have a role in that process, and it, you know, and it's checks and balances, you know, because man is greedy, and, you know, when man does get leadership,
sometimes
they leverage it for
women
greed.
Women are too.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. So we all have a role in it, and you're right, talking about it and, you know, creating awareness and bring it to the attention of the people so that the community can get involved, so the community has something to say, and that's how we fight the greed and corruption. It's a long, uphill battle, but that's what we have to do.
I promised all of my listeners we wouldn't get into politics.
Well, I don't think you can avoid politics, because politics is just another expression of human beings doing something together. It's all of
that's
this
it.
Politics.
You have politics
the mob
in every part
politics.
Of society.
Pardon me?
You can have politics in a church meeting.
I agree. I define politics as whatever happens amongst groups of people as soon as they get together. And a family has a political life. A church organization has a political life. The mob has a political life. Teams and organizations and businesses have political lives. And then there's what we traditionally think of as politics, which is just the greatest expression of all of that. But it exists, in my opinion, across the board.
Keith, you've co-authored the book. I'm certain that you're pretty happy about it. But what I'm interested in finding out is your, you know, ideas about the story. You know, could this have been prevented?
Well, Denny brought up a good point once on one of his shows. if Larry Newman had served his 120-plus year sentence, Ron Scharf and Patricia Freeman would still be alive today.
And
he
Robert
was
Brown.
Let out
That's
after,
a good point.
After 12 years. He
yeah.
was let out after 12 years.
And he killed three
How do you
people,
get,
right?
kill three people and get out in 12 years?
That is amazing.
Well, Frank also mentioned, you know, that's where Frank met Larry Newman, was in prison. And when you're in prison and you have the jobs and stuff like that, you don't get those jobs right away. They, you have to do some of your time, and it's a reward to get those jobs. Larry Newman came right into the Goon Squad, which was the medical job that they had. They were on the psych ward, and they're basically the Goon Squad. They would go ahead and hold down any prisoners and stuff that were, you know, going through issues or throwing fits or what have you. And he went straight to that job.
Okay. That doesn't make a lick of sense to me.
Does if Daddy is rich?
Yep.
I'm just one of those boring guys that has never even got a parking ticket.
That's the Illinois system. You know, you have to think that there's been a couple times in Chicago's history where they were going to go ahead and federalize the police department. They were going to throw away all the Chicago police and federalize it. Our corruption's so bad. Our corruption's still that bad today. I mean, take a look at our governors. There's more past governors pounding out plates now than there are serving in office, you know.
How is Blagojevich these days, anyway?
Yeah, he's in jail. He's in jail. What was it, the last three or two governors?
I think this made Blagojevich made three.
Yeah, that are currently sitting in jail.
How did Obama dodge that bullet?
I don't know. He didn't hang out with the same type of people. He hung out in the South Side, but in mostly the black districts. Even Jesse Jackson Jr., who recently, you know, is admitted to being corrupted in there. It's not easy. I was talking to Dennis Arnoldy about that, and the way that I best explained it was, these people don't really understand that they're being corrupted. It's just so inherent in the transacting through government there that they don't even know it.
Okay. Sam, I've got to ask you the question. Do you think that all politicians are inherently corrupt? I know that you're a bit of a Tea Partier.
I'm a libertarian. I'm not a Tea Party. Yes, I believe it has become such a corrupt. It's just crony capitalism and the politician. If you really want to read something that was great today, my son, who's at City University of New York School of Journalism grad school, sent me a story that was in the New York Times that David Stockman, if you remember him from the Reagan years, who resigned as Reagan's OMB man because Reagan was running up huge deficits, wrote a four-page opinion piece about how screwed up the country is and why. He basically came down to what you just asked me, Simon. All politicians are corrupt, and they're dealing with the corrupt Wall Street, corrupt big business, not the mess we're in. And when you get guys like David Stockman saying that, he must be listening to our radio shows on Sunday. but I am fascinated by the story of Newman. You know, I'm from Youngstown, is mini Chicago, guys. Okay, I don't know if you've ever heard of it. We've had all sorts of we've elected mobsters to elected office around here blatantly. And our FBI has been compromised, law enforcement's been compromised for many, many reasons. As Youngstown, we're halfway between Pittsburgh and Cleveland. two different families controlled them. There's always, you know, a lot of gambling around here, a lot of loose money because of the steel mill way back in the day, and people had money, and there was a lot of gambling. But anyway, as a matter of fact, the thing that was invented here was the car bomb. They used to call it a Youngstown tune-up.
Yeah.
And, that's what it was, you know, it was invented here. As a matter of fact, if you saw the movie To Kill the Irishman about Denny Green up in Cleveland, the guy who killed him was a Carabia, and they were the ones, they were from my town. I mean, they were the ones who invented that, the whole things, and their body disappeared, and that helped elect a guy by the name of Jim Traficant, if you've ever heard of him. So he was...
The nice hairdo.
Yeah, he drove. He was the sheriff, and he drove Crabbe's body wherever they buried him, and in somewhere in Ohio, because who would ever stop? No other sheriff in the other 87 counties in Ohio would stop another sheriff's car, so to speak. You know, professional courtesy, I guess. But I am just amazed by the stories you're saying and the names you're throwing out, and how you know, this guy, serial killer, loved it. I mean, what you just said, he's a guy who. Jewish, from a very wealthy family, to up that he had a trust fund, and high IQ, and he loved to kill people. That's what he did. And to the point that he probably is the type of person who, if he got pissed off enough over an ex-wife, believe it or not, he was just looking for an excuse to kill.
Yeah.
I mean, most people want to kill their ex-wife. He wants to kill somebody I say that tongue-in-cheek, of course, but he wants to kill someone because allegedly they got into a beef with his ex-wife. I mean, just amazing. And,
well, in our book, we talk about an incident with him where a woman of color borrowed keys from Jim Hager, and she didn't return them as fast as Larry thought they should be returned, and he wanted to go kill her for not returning the keys.
Yeah, well, what actually happened was just what Keith said. And as soon as Jim said, hey, you know, she's not back, it's been about a half hour, Larry said, well, let's go get her. And so they really had no choice but to go with Larry Newman. They all hopped in my dad's car, headed up to the gravel pit, and there she was, locking up the gate of the gravel pit. And Larry got out of the car, and he drew a bead on the woman, and she was there with her young son. And, you know, and Larry had to be talked out of killing her. You know, Jim had to tell her, hey, look, you know, this is my job. You know, you kill her, I'm going to lose my job. I'm divorced. I got all these kids to feed. And that was the only thing that could be told to Larry to talk him out of killing this woman. And me and my best friend, this was my best friend's grandfather's gravel pit. Me and my best friend knew the kid. His name is Curtis. And when we were growing up, one day Curtis was there, one day he wasn't. We never knew why until 30 years later.
Okay. Peter, I kept you delightfully in the dark about this program. But, you know, you hear something like what... you know, has just been broadcast. What do you think?
I think the same thing that I said before. I hear stories like this a lot more than you would imagine. And, you know, it's just, as I said before, it's just consistent with all the things that we've talked about. Another thing it reminds me of is, you got to try to be very careful in this world who you hang out with and who you associate with, because you don't know to what extent, you know, a seemingly innocent friendship can turn awry. And I speak from personal experience. You know, when you're friends with someone and you start to get the feeling that, you know, that they're not exactly the kind of person that you really like and look up to, or they have friends or other connections that you feel uncomfortable about, you know, sometimes you have to reassess that quote-unquote relationship, and that's hard to do, because as human beings, we're trained, we're not trained, we're hardwired to bond with others. We're hardwired to make associations, to form friendships, to form bonds, and to make those bonds meaningful. It's very difficult to try to to snap out of that. We all know the feeling of having someone who's a friend, and you know, we don't want to abandon them or let them down or hurt their feelings. You know, I mean, that's just one of the many thoughts I have when I hear, you know, tragedies like this unfold. It's just another example of the complicatedness and difficulty of being human beings. Another thing I was thinking of, in all honesty, is I watch a lot of the History Channel. And, you know, hearing stories about the mob always makes me think of stories of ancient Rome. And ancient Rome was run by people who, monarchs, who basically did whatever they wanted to do and were ruthless whenever they wanted to be ruthless. And that empire ended, but in many respects, all we have now are different multitudes of sub-empires and sub-monarchies that basically do the same thing in a more sophisticated and more modern way. But the same themes have repeated themselves throughout human history. That's another thought that comes to mind as I listen to this.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if that's okay, and I know that's a bit of a conversation ender rather than a conversation starter, but
oh,
it's
no.
honestly what goes
it's
through my mind
money.
When I hear these stories.
No, I think it's a great conversation starter. And, you know, Peter, you are... an attorney, you're a litigator, you spend time in court. When you open your mouth, you know, what you say is important. You know, you're persuading a judge, and the judge is someone that has spent many, many hours, you know, learning the judging process. So, no, what you say has great validity. Okay, who wants to leap in?
Well, I'll leap in with something. As Sam was saying before about corruption in Youngstown and all, take it to McHenry, or any police department anywhere, and politicians too. You could go in with the best of intentions, but if you're faced with corruption day in and day out, how long would it be before you would become corrupt?
A very good point.
I think that's what happens. I have to believe some men and women do go into politics with the best intentions, but you just said it. You're talking, you know, 80 years.
The old
years.
Saying of you got to go along to get along.
Right, exactly. Don't make no waves. I know the famous right. Don't make no waves, because guess what? You know, it's all about getting reelected. It's all about rewarding your friends. No, they realize it. It's not about public service. It's about taking from the public and
all
and
the pork that's added to the bills. You know, all the pork barreling that they add to the bills.
Right, that, right, yeah. And so who wants to be the one? And let's face it. And if you're the one who, you get in there, or whoever you are, at whatever level, and you stand up and you point the finger, and all of a sudden, you know, no one's standing behind you anymore. And all the guns of those guys who you're going to wreck their livelihoods start pointing at you. And they probably own the local media, too. I know around here they do, for sure. And, you know, it's a very tough road to hoe. And that's why I think most people are put off by politics, don't get involved with it. And now we just shrug our shoulders. I mean, one of the worst things we have, the best ally that this corruption has is apathy. No one cares.
Right.
Who wants to have it? Why
right.
would you? Why would you want to put your head on a chopping block?
Keith. I have to ask you the question. What is the solution?
To corruption?
Yeah.
Or to...
Corruption in government.
I would say we have to clean house and start all over.
That was short and sharp.
No, it's it's a complicated question, you know, and it's not easy. But you know what what is the one balancing act that we have? And that is votes. You know, the one thing that powerful people that are using their influence badly, the only thing that they're afraid of is the people and their votes. So this is where the community must engage. They must engage their process around them. You know, but think of what we're asking for the community to do, though, to pay attention, to engage the stuff that, you know, they find unsavory, you know, to listen to, like, local politics and stuff like that. But if they want justice and they want fairness, it's what they have to do. It has to come from the community.
And they also have to worry about who's counting the votes, Paul.
That's true. That's true. When you see corruption, you can't stand for it. You got to stand up to it, and you got to wrap around the community's got to wrap around that message and want to wrap around that message, because like I said, you know, when you go ahead and you stand up against the system, you're standing by yourself. The only people that can go ahead and reinforce that situation is the community.
Right, and I'll also add, if you're into corruption, you know, make sure you can pay for it.
They do. They got a billfold for that.
Okay, we're in the last parts of the program. I want to go once around the table and get people's final thoughts. It's been a wonderful program. I'm going to start with you, Paul. You know, you are the person that has the most vestment in the story. You know, do you really think that you can get some closure to your father's death?
Well, I think for me, you know, I mean, this went on 27 years. Right? You know, if it took me 27 years to wait for a conclusion, I would have been stuck still as a victim. You know, and I crossed over from victim to survivor many, many, many moons ago. But the, you know, the tenacity is to get to the bottom of things. You know, I want to, one, square things up so my family and the Freeman family understand fully what happened. And that is part of closure. So if that's what people are looking for closure, that's the conclusion that I want to drive. But I also feel strongly that, you know, given the opportunity with all this crazy circus that surrounds my father's story, that I have to champion it. Not so much for the Scharf or for the Freeman, but for the next person who falls to tragedy. I think about people, if this would happen to somebody today, would they have the mental capacity to deal with the grief of a lost one, but still campaign and campaign smartly to create awareness? And we don't want people to go through that. We want what justice should be, and that should be given. When these tragedies happen, they should be given, and that's the expectation that I want to create.
I'm sure you have no big beef with me. You know, I have followed your story, and I've run with it. You know, I want to see justice, but I'm just not sure that you're going to get it.
I would concur with that. But you know what I've seen in my story too is hope, and that's what we look forward to.
Okay, Keith, I had never spoken to you before today. I'd love to get your thoughts on this story.
Well, I think my mother summed it up best. She read the book sitting down last night, and she got on the phone with me. She says, there are a lot of bad people out there.
Oh, that is a truly splendid answer.
It's a short book review, but it's right to the point.
Yeah, it is.
Would you contemplate taking on another project along these lines?
Paul and I have discussed it. We wouldn't mind doing a biography of Larry Newman.
Yeah, that would take some work. That would take some traveling. That would take some money to actually go ahead and do. But you know, it's tough to immortalize just a good man, Ron Scharf. But you know, it's easy in our society to immortalize somebody like Larry Newman. And I'll attach my father to Larry Newman, and you know, and my father will live throughout that as well.
Okay. I was trying to do something clever behind the scenes and didn't work. So I do need to wrap this up fairly quickly. Peter, I deliberately kept you in the dark. Give me your parting thoughts.
Well, first of all, I'm grateful for being kept in the dark. I wish it would happen more often, so I thank you for that. Secondly, I really do find these subjects incredibly fascinating. I spend a lot of time thinking about these kinds of issues, and I think it's appropriate that we have this discussion on a weekend when we're contemplating Easter and we're contemplating Passover, and as broadly as I can frame these kinds of concepts, you know, we all want justice, but the achievement of justice and the achievement of this sort of perfect sense of justice is not always the most important thing, but I believe the pursuit of it is. It's the journey and not the destination, and I think we all need to keep trying to achieve it, no matter how difficult or unattainable it may seem.
Good thought.
And Sam?
I have just had an incredible time listening to the story of these ruthless people. I like the fact that you still use that great word hope out there, that maybe justice will come. I hope that it does for you. You deserve it. You killed the killer of your dad and his companion, friend, need to be brought to justice, even if they're dead themselves or whatnot, because that's the only way things ever get closed. You know, we've been closure to these things. Your idea of a book on Larry Newman, I think, is a great idea. Unfortunately, things like that are bestsellers, and books about night people like Simon don't sell anything.
That's
no one's ever used me as a book subject. Gentlemen, I have to thank you, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart. It's been a wonderful show, and I do hope that you've enjoyed it, and I want to thank my audience. Have a happy, healthy, safe week. We'll be back next Sunday. Who knows what we'll be talking about, but it'll be fun. Till then, goodbye.